Welcome to the Whiskey Rebellion. This is David here. We have a slightly unusual episode today. Instead of our usual conversation between Frank and myself, it's going to be in some ways a Frank solo show. So earlier this afternoon, Frank gave a lecture at the National Library of Scotland, just down the road on George the Fourth Bridge, reflecting on the first 6 months of the Trump presidency and trying to put it in some historical context. And so what we have for you this week is a recording of that lecture. There's some points in which Frank makes references to PowerPoint, which unfortunately you guys can't see, but I'm going to try to post some images of Frank giving the talk on our Facebook group and on Twitter. So that's all there for you. But before we listen to Frank, just a couple of programming notes. One, it's something we're really excited about. On August 16th, we're going to have our first live show as part of the Edinburgh Fringe Festival, or at least the university's contribution to that. And tickets for that are now available. So the show is going to be at 1 p.m. on Wednesday, the 16th of August, and it's going to be in the Anatomy Lecture Theater, which is a really cool space here in the old medical school. And I'll put a link to the free tickets in the show notes, and I'll put that on Twitter and Facebook too. And the second little piece before we listen to Frank talk, summertime is around, and both Frank and I are doing some traveling, so we're going to do our best to have regular shows throughout the summer, but we may be taking slightly longer between shows as both of us go to various points for holiday and work and whatnot. So if you don't get an episode when you expect it every week, don't worry, we'll have a show coming up soon. We're going to do our best to keep on track despite our travel. So all that being said, here's Frank.
Thank you, Dora, and thank you all for coming. I need to begin with an apology. Many of you were at my talk here in September, and although I didn't predict the election, I did tell you you had very little to be worried about because you could have a great deal of faith in the Electoral College. I'm sorry about that. That also suggests to me, or should suggest to you, that you should take everything I say today with a pinch of salt. So where are we now? Interesting. Oh, I should begin by giving a kind of preemptive, not just apologizing to you for misleading you in September, but also I should state that although I'm very pleased to be hosted by the National Library of Scotland, and I work at the University of Edinburgh, because we will be touching on matters of contemporary politics, my views are not necessarily the views of those institutions or are associated in any way with those institutions. Dora's nodding. Okay, so I think, just so you know. So I'm speaking for myself in this particular context. Where are we now? Well, Donald Trump has been president for nearly 6 months. I think I speak for many of us when I say it feels like a bit longer than that. He's coming up to his, it'll be 6 months in a couple weeks' time. I want to offer a couple of reflections, or several reflections over the next few minutes, but I also think that it's probably necessary for us to have a sort of cathartic, therapeutic discussion. So I'm going to leave some time for questions and answers as well, so we can all emote. I want to suggest to you that whilst there are real reasons for concern with regard to some of the things we've seen over the past 6 months, approximately, I think there are also some grounds for optimism, and I want to say a few words about those as well. Bearing in mind, I'm the guy who told you not to worry in September of 2016. So I'll say a few words about what I think has happened thus far, but also what we might expect going forward. So, as you know, Donald Trump was inaugurated on January 20th, 2017. There's one of the many, many images of his inauguration. You'll notice it's a much less diverse group of people in attendance than at either of President Obama's inaugurations. He's there with his wife holding the Bible for him, being sworn in by the Chief Justice, and his family is immediately to the right. Paul Ryan is looking incredibly smug and happy. I think that's something we might want to return to. Nancy Pelosi, slightly less so. But this is a kind of important moment. And one of the things we told each other, we told ourselves last January, was the peaceful transfer of power is really, really important, and it makes America really, really special. Well, this has been tested somewhat in the subsequent months. But this was a moment that was intended to be a moment of coming together. In the early days of his presidency, President Trump laid out a number of policies and policy objectives. Notably, he issued a travel ban on citizens from seven different predominantly Muslim countries. There's some dispute as to whether this is a Muslim ban or not, and he's used the language of a Muslim ban at different times in his tweets. By the way, I know Dora asked you to turn off your phones. If you could mute them, that's fine. But in the spirit of Trumpism, I really feel that you should tweet as you feel appropriate. He also vowed to repeal and replace Obamacare, which of course, or the health care plan adopted under President Obama, which has been a kind of cornerstone of Republican policy for the past 7 years. I think that's why Paul Ryan was smiling at the inauguration. He promised that a wall would be built along the U.S.-Mexican border and that there'd be a big infrastructure bill and tax cuts. He issued a series of executive orders related to some of these things. But one of the things I think you need to bear in mind, and that we should bear in mind in our discussion this afternoon, is that President Trump says a lot of things and he promises a lot of things. Actually, none of these things have happened yet. He hasn't. And while the rhetoric has been difficult, and the Supreme Court is going to render a verdict on the travel ban, and has partially or allowed for its partial enactment over the past few days, the number of achievements that President Trump has actually achieved, or the number of policy objectives that he's achieved, I should say, is pretty limited. He made great play about his first 100 days and how much he was going to get done in his first 100 days, and he claims to have done more in his first 100 days than any other president. It's simply not true. So there is a kind of disjuncture we have to keep in mind whenever we consider President Trump between what he says and what he actually does or achieves. Now, I think what he says can be problematic, and the desire, the sort of objectives behind much of what he says, to my own mind, is quite worrying, but we shouldn't necessarily believe everything we hear. So I want to look at foreign policy and domestic policy, and I've got two images there that are quite striking, and to some extent they speak for themselves. In the top left, you see there was a moment when Angela Merkel visited the White House, and the press gaggle was there taking photos, and they asked President Trump to shake Merkel's hand, and he refused to do it. And so there's the very famous image of him looking down like a chastened schoolboy, really. And it wasn't the most presidential moment. And, of course, the first visitor to the White House, the first foreign visitor, I should say, was Theresa May. And this is an image which I think will endure for some time of President Trump and Prime Minister May holding hands as they were walking outside the White House. And so, to some extent, in foreign policy, that's all you need to know. There was a sort of desire to embrace Britain, or at least a version of Britain in Trump's mind, but putting Europe at arm's length. And Trump's foreign policy has been, thus far, there's been very few achievements. So he pulled the United States out of the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which he said he would do. He threatened to pull the United States out of NAFTA, the North American Free Trade Agreement. But when the Prime Minister of Canada and the President of Mexico pushed back on this, he actually relented on that quite quickly. And we've yet to face a true foreign policy crisis yet during the Trump presidency. Now, inevitably, we will face such a moment. It seems to me the most likely trouble spot is North Korea, and there's been a ratcheting up of the tension between the United States and North Korea. President Trump has yet to be tested in a kind of profound way, the kind of proverbial, as Hillary Clinton put it, 3 o'clock in the morning phone call. If he's at 3 o'clock in the morning, that's when he usually tweets, so he'll be awake. But he's yet to face that really big crisis. There was a little bit, a kind of minor crisis, and I don't mean to downplay the significance of military action, but in early April, President Trump did order cruise missile strikes on an airbase in Syria. He had a slight boom in his popularity after that, or at least the decline in his popularity kind of leveled off slightly. So the polls benefited him, as frequently happens to U.S. presidents when they use military, when they resort to military force. And so it was debatable what was actually achieved by that airstrike, because the airbase seems to have been had been abandoned in part because the Syrians had been warned in advance about it. It's a complicated situation there. The Syrian situation, of course, is extremely complicated, not least because of President Trump's relationship with Russia. Can we call it a relationship? Frenemies? If it were Facebook, would we say they're in a relationship? I don't know. He's got an interesting relationship with Russia, and of course the Russians are on the ground and are very, very supportive of the Assad regime. And this was a case, this was an incident where the United States and Russia could have come into conflict. But it was a slightly, it was an interesting and worrying moment, but it didn't escalate as some feared. So that was the kind of big foreign policy moment. The other significant foreign policy issue concerns how he's treated close allies of the United States. And so in terms of domestic policy, what I've tried to tell you is he hasn't achieved a whole lot. In foreign policy, there's been a lot of bluster, a lot of damage to the standing of the United States in the world. There was a survey by the Pew Research Group that came out a couple of weeks ago about the kind of fall in American prestige and the decline in American soft power, as it's termed, in the six months since January. But relatively little has been achieved, except where the United States is closest allies are concerned. So although he's embraced, kind of literally and figuratively, Theresa May, the same hasn't been true of other NATO allies. So he spoke, he visited, he made his first international trip in May, and on that trip he went to see, he attended a NATO summit, as one would expect of the United States president, the United States being the leading contributor to NATO. And he gave a very, very odd speech. Now, he often gives odd speeches, but this was particularly odd because he more or less upbraided the closest allies of the United States. These are not enemies of the United States. These are the United States' closest allies. And he more or less said, you're not paying enough. And he made no mention of Article 5 in the NATO Treaty. And Article 5 in the NATO Treaty is basically the article where all the nations pledge to come to each other's defense if they're attacked. The only time Article 5 has been invoked in the history of NATO was in Afghanistan in the aftermath of the 9/11 attack. In fact, President Trump gave the speech at NATO headquarters, and in that setting was one of the girders from the Twin Towers in New York destroyed on 9/11. So this was meant to be a kind of symbolic moment. It was meant to be a moment that brought him back into the fold. And instead, he took that opportunity to insult his friends and hosts. And you can see the reaction there. Angela Merkel is doing her best Clint Eastwood impression, as far as I can tell. and the response was cool, to say the least. And that, of course, was the summit where he pushed the Prime Minister of Montenegro out of the way to get to the front and then sort of preened. However, I want to suggest to you that there are certain checks on President Trump. That this is the bit where I want to tell you where you can be reassured and take some comfort. And one of them is the response of the allies of the United States. So America's allies have been fairly robust in pushing back against some of the worst excesses of Trump's rhetoric, if not his policies. So to give you an example, which I mentioned in my introductory remarks, with regard to the North American Free Trade Agreement, that was an article of faith during the Trump campaign that he was going to remove the United States from the North American Free Trade Agreement, notwithstanding the abundant evidence that it's actually probably benefited the United States. But when he got a little bit of pushback from the Prime Minister of Canada and the Mexican president, he he actually backed down. And there were a series of tweets on that. I'll get to his tweets in a moment. But in which he said, well, they've agreed to negotiate. I've got them where I want them, so we'll give them another chance, or words to that effect. When he's met resistance, he's actually been quite responsive to it. Famously, he had dinner at Mar-a-Lago, his resort in Florida, in Palm Beach, with the Chinese premier. And after that, they seem to have established a good rapport. And so suddenly he did a bit of a U-turn with regard to China. He also said after that meal, North Korea is really complicated. The Chinese premier told me so, and he explained it to me, and it's very, very complicated. And so he has been responsive to both the influence, if you will, grudgingly. His rhetoric hasn't changed, but he's been responsive. So I think the allies of the United States have a kind of role to play. Now, one of the things that allies always say to each other is, well, true friends are willing to tell each other the truth in hard times. They don't mean that. You don't really want your friends to tell you what's wrong with you. But I think in this case, the NATO allies of the United States are making that clear. And there are some hints, I think, particularly with regard to intelligence collaboration, that, I mean, the Trump administration, in the aftermath of the terrorist attacks in London, for example, last month, you know, they leaked information that had been shared with regard to those attacks that was very upsetting to the UK government and very upsetting to law enforcement in the UK and to the intelligence community here. And that put in danger a key, notwithstanding the special relationship, and I say that, it's tomorrow's the 4th of July, so we're celebrating our divorce tomorrow, but notwithstanding all the romance one hears about the special relationship, to a certain extent, that's very much a security and intelligence relationship. And that relationship has flourished since the 1940s because both sides share intelligence and both sides know when to keep their mouths shut. And I think that Trump really committed a faux pas, or the Trump administration, I should say, when it began to leak that information in the aftermath of the London attacks. And the British pushed back about that. And if you'll notice, it was one of the rare times that the Trump administration issued an apology for anything, and also has kind of kept quiet after that. So I think the allies of the United States, as well as its adversaries, have a role to play in keeping Trump honest. He's discovered that he can't do anything he likes. And the role of the international community, tomorrow's the 4th of July, as Jefferson put it in the American Declaration of Independence, a decent respect for the opinions of mankind. Jefferson's much more articulate than Trump is. President Trump does not have a decent respect for the opinions of mankind, but the opinions of mankind matter, particularly those of the allies of the United States. And there's been some pushback, and I think that's been constructive and will continue to be so. I do worry about what will happen when and if there is a major international crisis, not of his own making, but and such a challenge will inevitably occur. Another thing we can take faith in, or place some faith in, and to a certain extent, for the Americans in the room, you can have some faith in your Constitution. The courts have worked, more or less. The judiciary is meant to be independent in the United States. It's meant to operate independent of political pressure. We know that's not always the case because appointments to the Supreme Court, for example, are inherently political. And indeed, President Trump has secured a place for Neil Gorsuch, a very conservative justice, on the Supreme Court. But in response to, and I'll call it a Muslim ban because Trump called it a Muslim ban, in response to the Muslim ban, the courts have pushed back. And the courts in the United States have repeatedly said that actions Mr. Trump has tried to take, or policies particularly associated with the travel ban, but not exclusively, are illegal, and knocked them back. And it remains to be seen where there will be a ruling in the autumn from the Supreme Court on the Muslim ban, which I think will go one way or the other. But the early response of the courts has been quite encouraging. It's essentially the Constitution operating as it should be. The quote I have there is of the Attorney General, Jeff Sessions, who famously, he claims tongue-in-cheek, although he's not a very humorful person, said, I'm really amazed that a judge sitting on an island in the Pacific can issue an order that stops the President of the United States. Well, the island in the Pacific was Hawaii, which is one of the 50 states in the United States. And basically, a court of appeals in Hawaii, a judge on the court of appeals in Hawaii, issued a ruling putting a stay on the travel ban. So that's what Attorney General Sessions is referring to. One hopes that the Attorney General of the United States, who's responsible for upholding and enforcing the Constitution of the United States, actually understands how courts of appeal work, and that he was being sarcastic. But the point is, the point we can take from this is, I think actually the courts have operated in such a way that can give one a degree of confidence and optimism. I think public opinion's been really important. And I've spent a lot of time in the United States in the past 6 months by coincidence. I spent about 3 or 4 months in different parts of the country since January. And what has been striking, and this isn't uniform, the opposition is not necessarily evenly distributed around the country, but there's a significant amount of public opposition to some of the policies and actions of the Trump administration. So the image you have there is an image of Copley Square, which is one of the main squares in Boston, Massachusetts. And why I selected this particular image is because this protest happened after the announcement of the Muslim ban, the so-called Muslim ban, in January. So you may recall that right after Trump was inaugurated, there were massive protests around the inauguration, and the day after Trump's inauguration, or a couple days after the inauguration, there was the Women's March on Washington. Well, those had been planned well in advance, and they were well attended. There were tens of thousands, millions of people globally who attended protests. These protests right after the travel ban were spontaneous. So I think this is quite telling. Now, whether people can maintain that level of enthusiasm to protest remains to be seen. But there were crowds like this that turned up across the United States, mainly in cities, in the aftermath of that. And they were spontaneous. And I think that bears consideration. And public opinion is an important, it's not part of the United States Constitution, just as the opinions of foreign leaders isn't part of the official mechanisms of the way the United States is governed. But public opinion matters. And President Trump's personal approval rating has been going in one direction, it's been going down since January, and it's now about 35%. Now, I'm not an expert on polling, as I demonstrated last September. however, I suspect that there's probably a ceiling. There's both a ceiling for his popularity and a floor for his unpopularity. And we're probably approaching that floor unless something really dramatic happens. I think there's probably about a third of the electorate that really does love President Trump no matter what he does. And we'll get to the tweets in a moment. But on the other hand, I think that the trend has been downward, and it's very, very difficult to govern with that level of personal disapproval. Because at some point, and I'll say something about this in a few minutes, at some point, Congress may turn against him, despite the fact that the Republicans control Congress, because congressmen and women will fear for their own re-election and their own seats. And so that personal disapproval rating is really, really important and something I think is worth bearing in mind. Another important element in all this has been the press. And the press, which previously, and I'm looking at my wife Mimi here, because it was in January of 2015, or it was January of 2015 when she told me, after we spent some time in the U.S., he's going to win because the press gives him such good coverage. She was right. I said, no, don't be silly. She's always right, but that's... he got a lot of very, very good and positive press coverage during his campaign. Since then, and since the inauguration, that has turned completely. Now, there are a number of reasons for that. First of all, the press now has policy to cover rather than simply the kind of three-ring circus of a campaign. Secondly, he's attacked the press. Thirdly, well, the New York Times has started to use the word lie. There's a degree of deceit that's gone on in some of his comments to the press. So this is the very, very first press conference that Sean Spicer gave the day after the inauguration. Some of you might remember this, when President Trump was obsessed with the size of the crowd for his inauguration, because the National Park Service had put out those photos that showed the crowds of President Obama's first inauguration and Trump's, and it was clear that more people turned up for President Obama's inauguration. Now, most people would say, oh well, but I'm still president. President Trump sent Sean Spicer, and I was about to say poor Sean Spicer, I don't really feel sorry for him, but sent Sean Spicer out there to lie to the press in his very, very first press conference. If you haven't seen it, please Google it and have a look at it on YouTube. And it's an extraordinary performance, not least because, of course, he was cutting out Spicer's legs from underneath him. Because the relationship between the press secretary and the press is incredibly important. And by sending Spicer out to tell what was clearly a demonstrable lie, he, being Trump, undermined Spicer's credibility, which makes it very, very difficult for him, that is Spicer, to get his message, get the administration's message across. And as a consequence of that, and because of the critical press that resulted, this was a headline in the Daily News the next day. I mean, Spicer's been savaged. He's been satirized by Melissa McCarthy brilliantly on Saturday Night Live. But you know, Spicer, Kellyanne Conway, Sarah Huckabee Sanders, all of Trump's spokespersons have essentially either deliberately or inadvertently misled the press or attempted to mislead the press. And a consequence of that has been a very, very tough press backlash. And the press, which is protected in the United States Constitution, it's the one profession that is mentioned in the First Amendment of the Constitution, the press serves a quite important, not just political role, but constitutional role. Frankly, I don't think it was exercising it very much before the election, but it certainly has since the election. And Trump is very, very concerned about the way he's portrayed in the press. He denies that he reads the New York Times, but clearly he does. Or it's read to him. Again, I assure you that I speak for neither the National Library of Scotland nor the University of Edinburgh. He clearly denies that he watches CNN or MSNBC, but he responds almost instantaneously to stories they air about him, particularly if they're critical. The press has a really important role to play in I think, trying to curb the greatest excesses of the Trump administration, not least because he's incredibly thin-skinned about it. Anybody who's president of the United States is going to be attacked by the press, and as they perceive it, attacked unfairly. President Obama could be thin-skinned, and he got very, very good press as a rule because he was very good at managing the press and managing his own image. All presidents get attacked, but President Trump is the first president who responds instantaneously, seemingly, to those attacks, and often responds inappropriately. So I think, therefore, so if I'm giving you reasons for optimism, that there are kind of checks on what might be the worst excesses of Trump, the first is watch what he does, not what he says, because actually there's a disjuncture there that's quite significant. Secondly, there are a number of checks that have emerged with some with real efficacy in the past 6 months. The response of foreign allies, the courts, the press, and so on. And I think these are really significant checks on what President Trump can do. Another is the states. We're seeing the emergence of what I might call, I've discussed this with my podcasting pal David about this, who's in the room. There's a new kind of federalism emerging in the United States. Now, states' rights, historically, whenever states' rights have been mentioned in American history, they've always been invoked to support white supremacy. So in the 19th century, states' rights was the clarion call of those states that wanted to protect and promote slavery. In the aftermath of abolition and down to the middle of the 20th century, states' rights were invoked to oppose civil rights. What we're seeing the beginning of, I think, is the emergence of what might be called a new federalism, a kind of progressive states' rights movement. It hasn't cohered as a movement yet, but I think we're seeing the start of it. We saw this when President Trump repudiated the Paris Climate Accord, so the United States wasn't going to participate. What happened was a number of states, and I have a picture there of Jerry Brown, the governor of California, and California led the way with the world's seventh largest economy. And Jerry Brown said, well, you can leave the Paris Climate Accord if you want, but California's not going to do that. And a coalition of states and municipalities has emerged, California, Washington State, New York, etc. But once you put New York and California in the same club, that's a significant proportion of the American economy, and they've said, we're going to adhere to the Paris Climate Accord. In recent days, the Trump administration has demanded that all the states turn over their voter registration information because they want to ferret out illegal voting. 27 states so far, and the numbers likely to rise, have refused to do so on the grounds that they don't trust the Trump administration to safeguard their data. I need to apologize. I hope the gentleman is in the room. Last September, somebody said, hey, do you think the Russians are going to hack the election? And I said, oh, please, don't be silly. I mean, sure, Putin has choosing sides, but they're not going to hack the election. Really, don't listen to anything I say. Anyway, but what you're seeing here is resistance from the states on a number of levels. And whereas state resistance within the U.S. federal system historically has, and I'm being provocative, but I think I can defend that assertion, has historically been about white supremacy and usually extreme right politics, we might be seeing resistance to the Trump administration from the states and a kind of progressive resistance. And California is all important in that, so which is why I selected Governor Brown. And, I mean, the bureaucracy has been important, the so-called deep state. This is a photo from the hearing a couple of weeks ago by James Comey, the former director of the FBI, who was fired by President Trump for investigating the links between the Trump administration and the Trump election campaign and Russia. Former director Comey was, of course, played a crucial role in the election itself when he told the country that they were investigating the Hillary Clinton email scandal in 10 days before the election. So Comey has had a quite interesting role in the history of the Trump administration. But Comey was testifying before the Senate a couple of weeks ago after his firing by President Trump, which is now being investigated by a special investigator, Robert Mueller, who's a former director of the FBI himself. The point is, it's not entirely clear that the federal bureaucracy is cooperating with everything President Trump wants to do. Whether it was an official of the National Park Service tweeting out a picture of President Trump's inauguration side by side with President Obama's first inauguration, down to this investigation. Now, people on the right in the United States, particularly Trump supporters, are making great play about what they call the deep state, that supposedly the kind of FBI and the CIA are out to get President Trump. I don't think it's necessarily as obvious as that. Basically, I don't tend to adhere to conspiracies, which is why I said, of course, Russia had nothing to do with it. It's more cock-up than conspiracy in my view. However, Trump and the people around President Trump have for decades run against the federal government and complained about the federal government and declared war on the federal government. And I'm thinking of people like Steve Bannon, Paul Ryan to a certain extent. And it's not surprising to me that the people in the agencies who are usually quite conscientious public servants aren't necessarily all that eager to kind of assist in their own demise. And so I think that the federal bureaucracy can resist in all kinds of ways. It's also the fact that President Trump is just not very effective at managing the bureaucracy. The number of key positions within the administration that have gone unfilled is fairly substantial, including 2/3 of the American ambassadors around the world. And so the bureaucracy is another kind of check, I think, on what might be considered, and again, I think it's a personal view here, the worst excesses of Trumpism. So that's what you can take comfort from. The bureaucracy, the press, the rule of law, and so on. Foreign allies. What should we be worried about? Well, the potential for political violence, and as violent as the United States can be, and I'm not here to tell you it's not, we don't have a tradition of politics of the gun. I hesitate as I say that because you could say, well, hold on. What about the 1960s? And there were a series of assassinations in the 1960s, and indeed there were. And again, I look at David, the entire politics of the 1850s and 1860s was the politics of the gun. But as a rule, For all the proclivity that Americans have for violence, we don't have that much political violence. So we don't have organized, you know, the armed wings of different political parties, for example. There's a danger that American politics could turn violent because of the violence of the rhetoric that we've seen not just in the past 6 months. Indeed, it antedates that. I mean, this has been going on for a few years, but this war is a kind of pathology, I think, in American political discourse. And we saw a manifestation of this back in mid-June a few weeks ago when a number of Republican congressmen and aides were shot while they were practicing for a baseball game in Alexandria, Virginia. Now, that was a terrible incident. I'm not sure we drew the right lessons from it necessarily, or are drawing the right lessons from it, because much was made of the fact that the shooter, the man who shot the Republicans, was a Bernie Sanders supporter. And so many people on the right and Trump supporters said, see, this is what we mean. It's those people on the left, or it's their rhetoric which is causing, you know, we're the people in danger. I'm not necessarily sure I agree with that. One thing I would observe is, and one of the man who was most grievously wounded in that is, it was a congressman from Louisiana named Steve Scalise. Scalise was an avowed sympathizer, I guess, with David Duke, the KKK leader, although he disavowed some of Duke's positions. And there was an irony there because he's a big opponent of LGBTQ rights, and let's just say not the most fervent supporter of civil rights in the United States for African Americans. The two Capitol Police persons who saved Scalise's life by shooting the attacker were African American, and one of them was a lesbian. So there's a kind of irony there, if nothing else. But the danger is the kind of advent of violence, and I think that's a real concern because of the other, if you will, pathologies in American life, particularly the widespread ownership of guns. The fact that we've experienced what sociologists call the great sorting, where Democrats and Republicans no longer live with each other, you know, no longer encounter each other, and so on. So I think that's a considerable worry. The other thing we need to worry about, and I'm not being facetious here, is Donald Trump's instability. I think that there's been a real erosion in political norms. It turns out lots of things that went kind of, lots of customs that were really, really important in American political life and lots of norms have gone by the wayside in the past 6 months. And again, the roots of this go further than the Trump presidency, go back further. But I think this is a real worry. So I've given you, and of course, it turns out these aren't even, you know, I was trying to keep up, but I did this 2 days ago, so it's not the most current tweet storm. I apologize, I'm out of date. Dora, we're going to have to do this about once a week. So this was his exchange at the end of last week with, we're back to his obsession with the media. So those of you, the Americans in the room may be familiar, there's a morning TV show on MSNBC, and the MSNBC network is seen as being left of center, called Morning Joe. And it's hosted by a man named Joe Scarborough, who's a former Republican congressman from Florida, and Mika Brzezinski. And it's supposed to be sort of, he's on the right, she's on the left. They're getting married, so there's some hope for American. Anyway, Trump was on Morning Joe a lot when he was running for president. They were very, very cozy. But Scarborough and Brzezinski have become increasingly critical of Trump, particularly since he's been inaugurated. And they were very, very critical. You might remember there was a story last week that President Trump had put up fake covers of Time magazine with his picture on them in all his golf clubs. So these were fake Time magazine covers that said Trump was really wonderful. And on Morning Joe, they mocked this. And Mika Brzezinski said very critical things about Trump. And he responded to this with the two tweets you see here. So, I heard poorly rated Morning Joe speaks badly of me, don't watch anymore. Then how come low IQ crazy Mika, along with psycho Joe, came to Mar-a-Lago 3 nights in a row around New Year's Eve and insisted on joining me? She was bleeding badly from a facelift. I said no. This set pair of tweets actually caused Washington to kind of stop last week and say, hold on, is this man unstable? He, of course, has a long history of attacking women who are critical of him and using quite graphic language to do so. And a number of Republicans came out, including conservative Republicans like Lindsey Graham of South Carolina, and said, look, this is beneath the dignity of the presidency. You've got to stop. And a couple of female Republican senators, notably Susan Collins of Maine, said, you have to stop. This at a very moment that the president needs all the support he can get if the Senate's health care bill is going to pass. So it's a maladroit moment, nonetheless. But I don't think he's necessarily in control of his faculties. I don't think he's thinking tactically when he tweets like this. And it's quite clear. These aren't, when you follow politicians' tweets, they're incredibly dull because they say things like, it's National Umbrella Day. Isn't that wonderful? But clearly, we're getting the unadulterated voice of President Trump when he tweets. But what's happening, so this whole incident was interesting on a number of levels because his spokespeople came out and defended it. So Sarah Huckabee Sanders came out and said, well, he fights fire with fire. That's what the American people want. And again, maybe his base of 33 or 35% wants it, but many people were outraged. And then on Saturday, he tweeted the following. My use of social media is not presidential. It's in all caps, so he's shouting now. Modern day presidential. Make America great again. Saturday was Canada Day. It's the 150th anniversary of the creation of the Canadian Confederation. Canada is the closest neighbor, and Pache Theresa May, the closest ally and friend of the United States, certainly its biggest trading partner. You would have thought his first tweet of the day would have been, Happy Canada Day to our closest ally, but instead it was this. So I think there's an issue there. So I think there are all kinds of reasons we might be optimistic. There are real reasons for concern. And I want to conclude with this and then throw things open to questions. The people we need to watch are these two guys that are in the picture with Trump. So on the left is Mitch McConnell, the Senate Majority Leader, who leads the Republican Party in the Senate. On the right is Paul Ryan, who can't help but look smug, who's the Speaker of the House of Representatives. Again, he controls the House because the Republicans are in the majority. As long as they support Trump, his political position is pretty secure. But you need to watch what they have to say. But I think the tectonic plates could be shifting in important ways. And I'm trying to give you cause for optimism as well as things we might be concerned about. Now, this is the advertising bit. Listen to our podcast, The Whiskey Rebellion. It's a play on words. We live in Scotland. It's whiskey, although we spelt it the American way. The rebellion as the Whiskey Rebellion was an actual historic event. So we took our name from that. You can find us on Podbean and on iTunes, and every week David and I get together and we talk about some of these matters and try to make sense of them. I'm happy to take questions, although as I said, my complete lack of insight where this is concerned has been demonstrated repeatedly. I'm surprised anybody's here but Dora and my wife. So anyway, thank you for your time.
The Whiskey Rebellion is hosted by David Silkenet and Frank Cogliano. David is a senior lecturer in American history at the University of Edinburgh, and Frank is professor of American history and Dean International for North America at the University of Edinburgh. The Whiskey Rebellion is available on iTunes, Stitcher, and Podbean. You can follow the show on Twitter at Whiskey Rebel Pod, and like the show on Facebook for updates about current and future episodes.